Welcome to the Caston Centre King and Wood Mallesons annual lecture. My name is Sarah Joseph. I'm the director of the Caston Centre. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I'd also like to mention that I think this might be the 10th year of the partnership between the Caston Centre and King and Wood Mallesons. It's been a very fruitful one, and I think if you look back through our respective websites, we've had some fabulous annual lectures, and I'm sure we will have another one today. I'm here to introduce Joanne Cameron, a partner from King and Wood Mallesons, Melbourne, and she specialises in large-scale and complex commercial litigation, including contract, trade practices, banking, finance and fraud. And I've just found out she's also the chairman of the advisory board of the Southern Territory's Salvation Army. Will you please welcome Jo, who will introduce our speaker today.
Thank you, Sarah. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. As mentioned, my name is Jo Cameron. I'm the partner in charge of the Melbourne office of King and Wood Mallesons, and it's my very honoured pleasure to welcome you to this year's lecture, hosted by King and Wood Mallesons and the Caston Centre for Human Rights Law. In particular, I would like to welcome our very distinguished guest speaker today, Professor Gillian Triggs, President of the Australian Human Rights Commission. It may come as a surprise to some, but not to this group, I know, because they know our association with the Caston Centre over a long period of time, but human rights does hold a great deal of interest for many of the lawyers at King and Wood Mallesons. In 2002, as many of you may know, we established a human rights group, and that group, very active in the Melbourne Centre, was established in response to the prominence of human rights issues that come across our desks, both in our pro bono casework, but also in our day-to-day practice of the law. Today, the group has over 150 active members in the office. It has a very active and passionate steering committee. There are certainly always the partners to increase our involvement in human rights. And the group advances the firm's expertise in this very important area. Recently, the human rights group has undertaken significant work to assist in the protection and promotion of human rights in Australia. I'd like to give you one example of the work they do. Mid-year this year, a team from the group represented a Sri Lankan Tamil client, together with his wife and his children, who had received adverse security assessments from ASIO. Although the family had been assessed as genuine refugees, the parents' adverse security assessments meant that they were being held in indefinite detention. Our team filed proceedings in the High Court of Australia, seeking orders that ASIO and the Minister for Immigration provide the family with procedural fairness, and we sought a declaration that their indefinite detention was unlawful. At the last minute, just ahead of the hearing before the full bench of the High Court, the Director General of ASIO reversed the adverse security finding, and the Minister for Immigration provided the family visas for release. After 4 years in detention, this was a wonderful result for our client and his family, and this is hopefully a significant step forward for the rights of detained refugees in Australia. The case came to us actually being identified through the King and Wood Mallesons Public Interest Litigation Clinic Partnership, it's quite a mouthful, with the University of Sydney Law School, in which final year students work with faculty members, solicitors and barristers to identify and run significant cases of public interest. We also have a range of other associations with important groups. For the fourth consecutive year, our human rights group has worked in collaboration with the National Children's and Youth Law Centre and Human Rights Law Centre to research, draft and publish a special children's law edition, the Human Rights Law Centre Agenda Bulletin. Recent experience in Australia and around the world suggests that businesses and governments alike can no longer afford to ignore the human rights implications of their activities. And in this sphere, human rights and business, the group comes into its own. Our relationships with our pro bono partners and organisations like the Caston Centre are very important to the firm and vital to the group's ongoing work. In this context, King and Wood Mallesons is very pleased to co-host each year with the Caston Centre a lecture presented by a leading individual in the field of human rights. Today's speaker certainly fulfils that role. Professor Gillian Triggs is the President of the Australian Human Rights Commission and took up her appointment in 2012. This role involves significant communication with Commonwealth, state and territory governments and with domestic and international bodies, lawyers, academics and advocates. Professor Triggs was previously the Dean of the Faculty of Law and Chalice Professor of International Law at the University of Sydney and Director of the British Institute of International and Comparative Law. She is a former barrister with 7 Wentworth Chambers and a governor of the College of Law. She has combined an academic career with international commercial legal practice, has worked with governments and international organisations, and has a long-standing commitment to legal education. I'm also very personally proud to say that she also, at one stage, and for a long time, had been a consultant with Mallison, Stephen Jakes, as it was then known. We're very honoured that Professor Triggs has found some time in her very busy schedule to be with us today, providing her views on why human rights matter to successful businesses. Please join me in welcoming Professor Triggs.
Thank you very much, Joanne. And I have to say, I really have been delighted to receive the invitation to deliver this Caston Centre annual lecture on the topic of business and human rights. I knew Ron Caston a little many years ago when he was, of course, practising and taking on so many pro bono human rights cases. And I remember one particular case of a man who was about to be deported. And Ron did absolutely everything he could, ultimately bringing the matter to the High Court, to argue that this man should not be deported and should be given refugee status. I was very impressed at that time with Ron's legal and advocacy skills and his very genuine commitment to human rights, little imagining that one day my own professional life would be engaged in this particular aspect of public international law, for asylum seekers do take up a great deal of my time as President of the Human Rights Commission. Well, corporate social responsibility is one of the most important challenges for business in the 21st century. There's an increased recognition at the national and international levels that respecting human rights is good for business. The Australian Human Rights Commission has also identified developing a positive relationship between human rights and business is one of its most important strategic priorities over the next couple of years. I too would like to thank the organisers of the event, the Caston Centre itself and King & Wood Mallesons. The Caston Centre has been doing some excellent work in the area. You'll know that in 2008 in partnership with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, released the Human Rights Translated, a business reference guide, which is a very valuable resource and demonstrates why human rights can and should be protected by business, both as an obligation and as a sustainable financial strategy. And of course, I am very happy to commend my firm, King & Wood Mallesons. I was with them for many years, as Joanna has said. They are the only large commercial law firm in Australia with a dedicated human rights practice, and I know they dedicate many of their resources to pro bono advocacy. Can I also acknowledge that we gather on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my very genuine respects to their elders, past and present. Well, this afternoon, what I'd like to do is give you some sort of a brief overview of the international framework for the responsibility of the international community for human rights implementation. But I then thought I would look at the work of the Human Rights Commission itself to attempt to encourage government and business to implement the 3 pillars under the guiding principles on business and human rights known as the RUGI guidelines on respect, protect and remedy. When I was thinking about what I might talk to you in particular today in this rather broad topic, I thought that as a former academic, I probably would have regaled you with details of treaties and case studies and evolving jurisprudence and said to you there are international legal obligations on businesses to do the following. Well, it's very interesting that although I've only been in this job for 16 months, my view of really 45 years in public international law has been somewhat moderated by the reality of day-to-day trying to achieve an implementation in Australian domestic law of the international legal principles that I've been so happy to talk about, both in commercial practice and as an academic. So I did think that I would concentrate today on the more practical aspects of what it is that the Human Rights Commission does. But perhaps just to mention, the Kasten Lecture is, of course, very timely because next week the Australian government will assume the G20 chair, which provides Australia with an opportunity to put the human rights on, put human rights on the economic agenda for that group. The G20 members account for 85% of the world economy, 80% of global trade, and two-thirds of the world's population. So this position for Australia as chair does provide a significant opportunity to link economic growth with fundamental rights and freedoms. And let me give you just a very, perhaps even banal example of the way in which community demands for greater social responsibility for business is arising. Just a few days ago, close to home in Adelaide, the Sunday Mail reported that a local clothing shop was selling T-shirts with the word retard on the front. The public response in Adelaide has been one of real anger and outrage that these products demean those with intellectual disabilities, just at a time when the community is starting to understand mental illness and to support efforts to respect and support those who are afflicted. The director of the company is reported to have withdrawn the product immediately, but demanded the suppliers take back the stock. Well, the suppliers apparently have refused to do so. But the point of mentioning this instance is that the impact can be very significant for an otherwise successful business, and it seems commendable at least that the shop itself has understood that a socially responsible response will ultimately be in its best interests. And there are all sorts of other examples that one can talk about in terms of a growing community recognition of the role and the important leadership role of business in implementing human rights in practical ways. Qantas, for example, works with the supply nation to ensure that the supply of many of the products it delivers are provided through an Indigenous body that enables Indigenous groups to supply particular services and goods. KPMG works with the particular Indigenous groups in partnerships. Westpac provides leadership in creating sustainable housing that's designed for rural community living. Lendlease works with community housing in certain areas. There are numerous examples of Australian businesses coming to grapple with the ways in which they can adopt socially responsible policies. The support for integrating human rights in economic strategies is very clear when you look at the buy-in to the United Nations Global Compact, which broadly creates a voluntary commitment to human rights in developing strategic policy for the business community. That compact now has 12,000 participants across 145 countries, and there are almost 8,000 Australian businesses, along with universities, NGOs, government bodies and other agencies that are now part of that global compact. There are around 120 Australian signatories, and the network is growing. The Australian Human Rights Commission, of course, takes the position that when businesses breach human rights, particularly in the context of the four primary pieces of legislation that for which we're responsible, dealing with race, sex, disability and age, those businesses will obviously be in violation of Australian law, with all the attendant consequences of conciliation procedures and possible forms of compensation, and ultimately, though in very few cases, federal court litigation. However, a vital tool we have come to believe to achieve human rights outcomes, which are obviously our first priority, is to achieve systemic change on a voluntary basis. And one way to do this is to make the business case for human rights implementation. Global and Australian research indicates that there's a strong business case that gross domestic product will increase significantly in economies that achieve diversity in employment, equality of opportunity, and recognition of merit. The UN, the OECD, the World Bank, Asian Development Bank, Human Rights Council, each agrees that there's a direct connection between good business and fundamental human rights in building economic and social development and entrepreneurial productivity. If we take, for example, the area of age discrimination, the Commission appointed Deloitte's Access Economics to conduct primary research to measure the economic impact of employment participation rates for people over 55 years of age. The study found that in 2012, an increase of 5% in paid employment for Australians in that age group would have led to a $48 billion impact on the national economy in that year alone. The study also found that in 2011, 18% of the unemployed over 45 said that they believed that they were unemployed because of a prejudice against them. And a 5% increase would, in human terms, mean an extra 750,000 people over 55 could be in paid work rather than depending on current government benefits. So that example alone demonstrates that were we to be more careful about discriminating, as we clearly seem to be against particular age groups, we would untap a very significant resource for benefit to the national economy and, of course, to the companies concerned. With regard to sex discrimination, Goldman Sachs have reported, both on their American-based research and Australian research, that in 2013, if the gaps between male and female employment and productivity were to be closed, it would boost Australia's GDP by 13%. The Grattan Institute has concluded that a 6% increase of women in the paid workforce will expand the Australian economy by about $25 billion a year. And the same argument applies in relation to disabilities and to race and Indigenous employment. And the evidence is now really compounding, both internationally and within Australia. Embracing human rights helps a company manage business risks such as litigation, damage to stakeholder relationships, reputation and brand image. Compliance with human rights creates new business opportunities, including strategic advantage in emerging markets. And one that my colleague, Susan Ryan, who I'm sure you all remember, the first woman to be appointed to a Labor cabinet, she's now the Age Discrimination Commissioner, is constantly telling me about businesses who've identified that the people with the money are actually in that top echelon. They should be developing products and selling to that market, not only, of course, employing them. And a very good example of a company that has embraced human rights, and I'm reasonably unashamed, I think, in mentioning particular companies, but this one, Rio Tinto, has a policy that works globally for them as well as in Australia, and it has a significant impact on their activities and culture as a whole. They have a report or a policy why human rights matter, and they have in particular embraced a policy of free, prior and informed consent in their extractive minerals industries globally. They are the largest private employer of Australian Indigenous people, our First Nations people, and they employ 7% of the total workforce in Australia, which is quite extraordinary. And they have been, in their website, identifying what they see as the challenges to their businesses if they fail to respect human rights. They say human rights, or getting human rights wrong, can pose real risks. They include operational delays, legal challenges, reputational harm, lost opportunities, investor concern, and employee dissatisfaction. For our business, they say, to succeed, we need to understand and manage human rights risks. We must act responsibly in respecting human rights in both developed and emerging economies in our core business. Now, that's a very positive story, but I also have a rather, perhaps a curious one that I think I can say without giving too much away, but perhaps some of you will be aware, certainly those of you who maintained an interest in public international law, that we had a long-term problem in the Western Sahara. After Spanish colonialisation, the United Nations held a plebiscite, and that plebiscite essentially was for independence. But rather than independence occurring in Western Sahara, the Moroccans engaged in what was rather euphemistically termed a green march, and literally took over the northwestern part of the country, leading to a civil war with the Polisario. Now, the upshot of all of this rather complicated background is that Western Sahara does not have recognised statehood in the international legal community. But it does have a lot of prospects, and companies and extractive industries work there to a degree. And I was asked to give some legal advice before I took up this position, because I can't do that anymore, but to advise the company on how they were going to manage this. But because they were clearly making a profit, it's one of the most important phosphate industries in the world, and very important as this has declined in Australia. But they were worried, because they were worried about their reputation, worried about social responsibility, and what the legal consequences might be as years go by on the ultimate rights of the peoples of Western Sahara to independence consistently with the UN plebiscite. And we talked about various ideas, if lawyers will. What about setting up an escrow account for a percentage of the profits that could be held and ultimately distributed? What about making sure that there are proper services within the area in which the mine was operating, you know, school, opportunities for women to work, opportunities for education and health services? Now, these were all discussed around the table, but nobody seemed to really know what was going on there. And I said, well, has any of the directors of this very well-known international company, has any of the directors ever been there? Have they ever looked at what the conditions are really like, talked to the people, seen what their concerns are and how they feel about a non-renewable resource being used in this way under a Morocco concession agreement? And the directors sort of looked at each other somewhat bemused and said, well, no, not one of them had ever been there. Had it ever had any connection with the actual working operations of the mine, although they said maybe they, you know, obviously their managers did, but they'd never been as directors of the company. And I said, well, you could, for $10,000, one of you could get a business class airfare over there and go and have a look. You fly to Paris and you get a 2-hour flight down to Western Sahara. It wouldn't be difficult. But surely these are the ways in which you can be a little more connected with the extractive industries, and at the same time, of course, protect your business reputation. But that was merely a war story, and it is, of course, one thing for a major transnational company to understand the link between economic outcomes and human rights. They are well-resourced, they employ skilled professionals in personnel to stay abreast of changes to human rights and discrimination law, and to implement those laws, as they almost invariably do, in their management policies. But it's quite another for human rights policies to be recognised and adopted by small to medium enterprises. It's in respect of the smaller, often family-run businesses that human rights are most likely to be at risk. And this point is all the more powerful when it's understood that small to medium businesses employ about 7 million Australians. And I have to be straightforward in saying to you that small to medium businesses are very quick to point to the Australian Human Rights Commission as being part of that regulatory environment which adds costs to their business without, in their view, any really significantly valuable outcome. It's a transactional cost, it's a red tape, and it feeds in, of course, to political concerns about what the role of the Human Rights Commission is and whether it really is providing a valuable service to the Australian community. And that is something that we have to be very alert to in developing our priority over the next year or so, the perception that we're really just in the way, we're really just imposing regulatory controls in a way that are not financially sustainable. And so I am very keen to turn that argument around and to understand the research which suggests that diverse communities in employment and ones that abide by fundamental principles of human rights law as they're implemented in Australia will ultimately be to their best interest. Well, the Australian Human Rights Commission is, I believe, in a unique position to observe the extent to which businesses are pivotal to achieving practical human rights in Australia. And this is because of the overwhelming number of inquiries and complaints that we receive that apply annually in the area of employment law. When we distill, and I won't go through all of what we do, but when we distill the work of the Commission, and at least a third to 40% of our work is concerned with the complaints mechanism set up under our legislation, and that leads to, on average, 17,000 or 18,000 complaints a year, inquiries and complaints a year. Those complaints are something like 70% related to the employment context. Some to services and delivery of services and products within the community, But basically, if we distill and try to understand what the Commission actually does confidentially and away from the media spotlight, it is in the area of working with businesses to try to achieve better outcomes in relation to allegations of complaints about age, sex, disability and the rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. And that's why the Commission is now prioritising this question in our education and advocacy work, the aim being to achieve systemic change, as I said a moment ago, predominantly on the basis of voluntary codes of conduct, rather than drawing these companies into a complaints process. Nobody really likes it, and it's far more healthy for us to work with these companies right at the beginning, or with small businesses, rather than bringing them into the Commission to conciliate matters that can be rather embarrassing and difficult. It's very often the case, that, of course, that the senior managers who come into the Commission to deal with complaints against them will often say, we had no idea that a particular person was abusing someone on the grounds of race in the canteen, or that somebody had been mysteriously let go 2 weeks after they'd announced they were pregnant, or that somebody didn't get a promotion because they were 55, but the 25-year-old with far fewer qualifications got the job. The managers are often quite unaware that this is occurring, but once they become aware, they can go back to their businesses and start to achieve some sort of systemic change. So that's the path we would really prefer to go down. But let's return, perhaps, to the beginning, and that is with the development of modern human rights law and see what's been happening in the international arena before I come back to the domestic sphere. And that, of course, is the begin, I think, is a good place to start, 1948 Universal Declaration on Human Rights. And I love to start here because you'll all be aware that it was our brilliant, if rather testy and demanding Doc Evatt who was the powerhouse behind Australia's support for the Universal Declaration and who was importantly at the time President of the United Nations General Assembly when he managed to ensure that that declaration went through unanimously in 1948. Well, that declaration, I do refer to a lot because that really was the fundamental rights that reflected evolving jurisprudence in the decades beforehand, indeed in some instances the century.